I'm like, this is the sort of book where the introduction is going to spoil everything.
Yeah, everything. Yeah, definitely.
That's how you know it's a classic, because the introduction assumes you already know the story.
Yeah.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
For masochists and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the genres and types of literature, regardless of our actual interest in them.
Every month, we read books from a new, randomly picked genre. Then on the podcast, we discuss our reading choices, experiences, opinions, appeal factors, and other related topics as friends and library workers.
In this, episode number 151, we're discussing the genre of classics.
I'm Matthew. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I'm RJ. I am also a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Stolo people.
My name is Anna, and I'm a librarian in Las Vegas, Nevada, USA, which is located on the traditional homelands of the Nuuvi Southern Paiute people, including the Las Vegas Paiute Tribe and the Moapa Band of Paiute.
My name is Megan. I'm an archivist in the National Capital Region of Canada, which is also where big government lives. And I live and work on the unceded and traditional territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg.
So what is a classic? What are we doing here?
First, announcements.
Oh, announcements. I'm sorry. I don't have the notes up.
It's fine. There's only one, which is that you made a book list, as usual.
Great. I made a book list. For the last few years, we've been making book lists of titles by authors of color, Black, Indigenous, and people of color authors, for every genre that we cover, and retroactively for genres we've covered in the past. And so we've got a list of, I think, 22 classic novels, I guess classic fiction. I think there might be some short stories mixed in there, by Black, Indigenous, and people of color authors. And so part of my, I think, definition of what a classic is, I had to figure out while I was making this book list.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. What counts as a classic is really so... Like, it's one of those things where, like, I don't think two people are going to agree on the definition of a classic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it also is, like, depends on the format as well. You know, like, a classic graphic novel is... Like, the age requirement there is going to be a lot less. Like, Mouse was a classic in the 90s, but it had been out, like, 10 years.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many other, like, novels or prose would feel the same way.
Yeah. For the book list, I chose the time range sort of arbitrarily, but also not. I can't remember now if it was 20 or 25 years. I think it might have been 20 years. There was one that got into... that I chose for the list from 1989 and that felt like I think that's the most recent one. It felt like that was early 90s were the cutoff.
I feel like that's before some of our listeners were born.
Sure. Yeah. Oh yeah. I felt like fine doing that.
Yeah.
And I'll say there's a pretty good mix on the list of books from like different decades of the 20th century and the 19th century. And I think there might be one book from the 18th century. Or maybe there's more than one. Anyway, I tried to get a good variety on when books were from. But there are a few from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Often when I think of classics, I end up thinking about the things that we have to read for like high school. And one of the things I ended up doing then was going, I found a list of like what books should you probably read in preparation for like AP English exams. Because I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like the place in which classics exist in terms of the way we conceive of them, right? On the most plain and boring idea of what a classic is. And so I ended up looking at that list a little bit, which was entertaining and interesting to see the way in which this person had divided things out, because they had them in sort of eras, and the eras went all the way up to like the basically from like the most recent eras, 1990s to present. So they were pulling out things like the process of identifying what are classics is actually always ongoing. And it happens to our literature as it's coming out. I mean, that's what a lot of the, you know, who wins big prizes and things like that is all about, is kind of like sifting through everything that comes out to decide what we're culturally going to identify as the classic.
I had a friend years ago who was going through, I can't, it was like one of the big literary awards, and was reading all the nominees. And he's like, I've never heard of any of these books.
Yeah.
And it was just like, what, even if something wins a prize and is like, you know, very important right now, whether anyone talks about it in 10 years or not, like, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what is going to stick around. Like, sure, some people, I'm sure there's some that it's become like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Whereas, you know, like people are like, oh, this is going to be a classic. And so because everyone says that, it becomes one.
Right.
But at the same time, like the introduction to the one I read this month said like, oh, people don't talk about this book anymore, which I thought was really kind of wild to even think about. So, yeah, things definitely – it's not a static thing. You can be a classic and then you can stop being a classic and then you can probably start being a classic again.
Right.
That's probably an important awareness to have, that – the classics are mutable and not set in stone. We're always discovering new classics and downgrading other ones, I guess.
So, okay. So when we're talking about defining these, here's my question for you. Does a classic have to be good? Does a book have to be good to be considered a classic? And what made me think about this was like all of Shakespeare's plays, because there's a lot of them.
Sure.
What?
What is the one in it? Like that there's a lot of them? Or like...
Or that some of them are not classics.
No. I said what? Because the first thing you said was Shakespeare.
Yeah. But it's just like I looked at all of his plays on Goodreads. And one... And like I hadn't heard of a lot of them. And like the lowest rated one was King John, which I'd never heard of. Which is rated 3.33 out of 5. And has like 6,000 ratings. I'm like, is that a classic? It's really old.
It raises an interesting question about how much we actually function on classics as individual texts versus classics as authors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I really think we end up running more on classics as authors than classics as individual texts as you get, particularly as you get farther in time from the individual books.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like once an author is a classic, then anything they wrote is worthy of, you know, like people writing papers on them in university. Whether it's like a finished book or like, you know, they're unfinished letters that they wrote to somebody or whatever it happens to be.
I don't think people writing papers on something in university make something a classic or not. Because there's a certain amount of like grist for the mill in academia.
Yeah.
Like you have to write on something. So you have to go like farther and farther out to find something to talk about.
Right. So I was going to suggest what you then get is the, just because an author becomes a classic does not mean every single one of their items that they have written stays in memory. What happens is we have a memory of a certain few things, the like top tier and mid tier of their list of whatever they've created. And then the rest of them just don't exist to us. And so then what you get are the papers in college from people writing about the forgotten book or, you know, the one that nobody discusses that actually really, you know, highlights XYZ thing about the world or life or the author or whatever else, the theme. So yeah, that like you say, Megan, that's kind of the grist for the mill sort of process of things.
I think I also do wonder like how when thinking about things falling out of classic status, it's like there's probably like the human mind can only remember so many things, you know? And so things are going to fall out of it just because we can only remember so many classic books that exist.
I want to go back to Matthew's original question about whether or not classics have to be good and just sort of push back to like, what is good anyway? About as nebulous as the classics is.
Yes. What is good?
Fair.
I literally just put like what is a classic into search because it's just like, I'm curious what pops up. So just like classic popped up with the little, like, you know, here's your definitions from it. And the first thing is judged over a period of time to be of the highest quality and outstanding of its kind. The next one is remarkably and instructively typical.
Typical. Interesting.
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting. Remarkably and instructively typical.
That's like, that's the platonic ideal of the whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess I can see that as a definition, but it still is not what I would come up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other question I have for folks is, are there any books you can think of that you think should be considered classics that aren't?
I mean, that's so tough because I feel like there's so many things that, like, in certain literary circles are considered classics and in others are not. Like, I think the book that you read this month, Matthew, I mean, you said in the introduction, just the one book that you read, right?
I've read several adaptations as well. So do those count? We'll discuss.
We'll discuss.
Can we go Ferber here? The work?
Ferber? Ferber.
Yes, the work. I feel like depending on what, you know, what literary circle you're in, spoilers, it's a Shirley Jackson books, book that, I feel like we've talked about Shirley Jackson a lot on this podcast, but I feel like in some literary circles, they would not necessarily, they'd be like, yeah, I guess The Lottery is classic, and then not necessarily think of her other work as classics with a capital C.
Well, the thing is, I found my book in the classic section of the library. So
validation.
It's had like a big C on the spine to indicate it was supposed to go in that section. So obviously it's a classic.
Yeah.
I just picked up something that said Penguin Classics on it.
Definitely. Definitely counts as well. Like, this is how we define them.
Yeah, mine is cloth bound. Yeah, it is also a Penguin Classic.
I was just thinking, RJ, like looking at your bookcase over there, that you can tell a book is a classic when it is like a fancy hardcover with no dust jacket and it comes with one of those like ribbon bookmarks.
Yep. Into you were it. Looking at A Christmas Carol and Other Christmas Stories.
Yes,
by
exactly.
Dickens. Yeah.
Definitely. So yeah, were there any other titles that people thought, or were there any titles that people thought should be considered classics that maybe are not?
I think that you bring up that interesting topic about like depending on who you're talking to. Because like one of the things when I was, you know, back in college and I did an English literature degree and I focused on like the kind of the early examples of what we considered a novel in Britain, in England. And so there's the ones that we kind of sort of remember and think of more easily, which is like Daniel Defoe. And then like Moll Flanders or Robinson Crusoe, or like Jonathan Swift. But there's a whole lot of actually books by women, and a lot of them were epistolary novels that came out in the same time. And nobody remembers those. Nobody reads those. There's all these like Evelina and Clarissa and stuff like that. And nobody reads those, but I read those for my final project, my honors project for my English degree. And honestly, they were as good or better, sometimes more compelling than the ones that we talk about. And so it's one of those weird little pieces of like what settled in at various times into being considered the classic. And then it sometimes is actually very hard to move that at a certain point. Like it can just kind of get set that way because that's just the easy thing to put on there over and over. And there's so much material already pre-produced for teaching and training about that item. So you just keep doing it again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to make one correction, Anna, which is to include Ireland in the list of places you mentioned, because otherwise my parents might get upset at me.
Yes, okay.
No, that's a good point, that there is so much material, and once something has gotten into the rotation, I guess.
The canon.
Mm-hmm.
The canon. True. We haven't talked about canon yet. I don't wanna. But there's always a great opportunity to like go back and read adjacent and figure out new classics if you want to. But it, I think it behooves people to read around maybe the genres that they're already interested in, like my experience reading Melissa Scott, Trouble and Her Friends, really gave more depth to my appreciation for cyberpunk, for example. So I think going back and like digging a little deeper in some of your favorite genres is a great way to explore classics.
I think that's a great point to bring up as well, Megan, because in that same article about like the AP books, one of the first things that they said at the beginning of it was like, read for prepping for the AP exam, read literature, not genre titles. Mm. So like, yeah.
Oh no, do we have to discuss that Twitter thread?
No.
A, yeah.
A, which one, and B, no.
Yeah, really? Yeah. That was like definitely stood out to me when I was reading that, as I'm like, yeah, that's like, that's if you go by the classic definition of what are the classics and what are they supposed to be reading in order to be well-rounded, which is like the exact opposite of what this does, is you read the approved set of literature from the canon, as it were. Yeah. So there's so much there.
I feel like maybe you could get away with some like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and some Frankenstein and maybe some Dracula.
Everyone does love Dracula right now.
It's true. Bailey Dracula.
Popular. Yeah. I feel like there are so many subcultural classics that mm-hmm. don't cross over to mainstream classics.
Yeah.
I was just like looking at my shelf and I've got a Roger Zelazny, who is an author that I like discovered from like other, you know, contemporary sci-fi and fantasy authors who were talking about him on a podcast, but has like a huge body of work and like is treated in, you know, their circle of sci-fi writers as like a classic author, but is not like, I don't think, well, I don't want to say I would never be assigned in school. I actually was assigned a short story for him in like a college writing class. In high school, I don't think would ever be assigned. Yeah. Would not reach that same sort of status as a Frankenstein or what have you. And not just because that's much older, but because it is part of this subculture of sci-fi from like a specific time in the 20th century that just never crossed over into like mainstream readership. I'm also thinking about like queer and trans literature, like Stone Butch Blues by Leslie Feinberg.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you ask any trans person, like, what's a classic trans novel, like they can name that. But I don't think that is something that would be considered a classic by Penguin Classics or whoever. I'm also looking at, I don't think I want to say the title because it is just the F slur, but by Larry Kramer. Which is like many people on Goodreads, I'm looking right now, have tagged it as classics, but is just so of its subculture and is a classic, certainly for a subgroup. But yeah, a classic is so dependent on context.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely one of the things I thought about, too, is like, why do we have the concept of classics? Like, what is the purpose of a classic?
How much of it is a marketing tool?
We do also have a tradition of like self-improvement through reading, like this idea that there was an everyman's library and you would go to the librarian and the librarian would give you a reading course and classic literature and it would be like, I don't know, morally uplifting and self-improving in a kind of way.
Oh, deadly boring.
When people complain sometimes about the types of reading other people are doing as not worthwhile types of reading, it's because they've got this division in their head of fluffy, enjoyable, and this may be genre, it may be YA, it may be women's literature, whatever that means, and this other classic self-improving has stood the test of time. Whereas, well, that's very contextual. But that's like the hoary background that we have attached to the idea of classic.
Another question.
Yes.
Do we have different designations for fiction and nonfiction classics?
I don't think people tend to think immediately of nonfiction classics, except for the fact that there are absolutely some things that we, if you said, because spoiler, guess who read a nonfiction classic? There are some things that if you say, I read this as an example of a classic, everybody would be like, yeah, of course, that totally counts. So like, I don't think we tend to mentally categorize them immediately in the same place, but they also, like, once you give examples, end up getting categorized in the same place. Partially because I don't think classic is like, classic includes a lot of materials that were written from times in which we were less settled on this idea of the novel as the way in which we communicate literary fiction, right? And so there's a lot of more consideration of poetry and plays and all these other things, and they all get lumped under the same heading of classic. So it's a little more forgiving of format and genre. Well, format and what? Fiction versus nonfiction? What is that?
Content?
Not genre, but...
I feel like in looking for classics this month, the nonfiction ones that kept coming up were memoirs. Like, that is again, format, content, question mark. That is a structure that we have decided, like, that can be a nonfiction classic. Like, memoir is allowed.
I would say one last note on nonfiction is just that there are still, in line with the idea of classic as a exemplar, also classics of each sort of type of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So that's a classic of the field, as it were.
Yep.
Backgrounds.
Do we want to talk about backgrounds?
I think we can just skip that.
I mean, like, Dad, did any of us totally avoid reading classics?
I read some for school. Yeah. I read some...
Not for school.
Not for school. I did go through a whole phase where I did a lot of classics on audiobook, where I had a driving commute that was like about an hour long, and I worked at a library that had not a huge audiobook collection, but had a lot of classics in it, and I felt like that was a really good way to consume some of that without, consume some of that in a easier way, where if I did not totally parse something because the language was dated or there was like a reference I didn't understand, I didn't dwell on it too long. It just moved along.
That reminds me of one I listened to some of recently, which was an adaptation of Beowulf. Mm. Like not an adaptation, a modern translation of Beowulf, which used the word bro a lot.
Oh, no.
That's fun.
Yeah. Is that still a classic at that point?
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. All those adaptations of classics.
Well, it's translation is the other thing. It's like,
yes, but still.
Where's the line when it comes to translation versus adaptation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A whole nother discussion.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, what's more interesting maybe than like our background in classics is where do you stand now in terms of reading classics? Because, like, I feel like it's not uncommon for people to have to read a bunch of classics in high school and college, maybe, and, like, then really not much after that. Or maybe for a couple years in their young adult lives before they're like, yeah, I don't care anymore.
Well, the fun thing is that there's so many classics in different languages. And I was exposed to a very... very small percentage of like English classics. So exploring other cultures' classics is really fun to me on occasion.
Mm-hmm. I think for me as a reader now, in terms of classics, it's a lot easier to do with others than to do alone, because that's how I experienced most classics, was in a school setting where we unpacked them together. They were a sort of a collaborative reading experience. Which gave me a lot more opportunity to get more out of that reading experience. And I feel like now reading them alone, they may or may not still be enjoyable, but I may or may not have the motivation to keep going because, like, when I'm not actively reading it, I may not just have the, like, drive to go back and keep going with it because I'm not going to share it, like, as opposed to in an environment where I am going to be able to, like, unpack and share with someone else. And that was actually, like, one of the things I loved about studying English literature in school, right? Like, that was one of the explicit reasons why I was an English literature major is because I could just, it was like it, literally what you did. You read the thing and you talk about it with others over and over and over again.
Just like a podcast.
Just like this podcast.
Hey, what do you know?
I don't read things outside of things for this podcast, as I think we've established in the past. So so I'm not reading any extra classics right now.
I only read science fiction novels if it's not for the podcast. So there's probably some of those that would count. I looked back over what I've read in the last couple of years, and one of them I'm just like, oh, I think that was in like a classics of sci-fi, you know, series or something that was put out. So clearly, but like, has anyone heard of it before? No one has heard of this book before. I can't even remember the title of it. Yeah, I could see it being interesting to discuss, but I wouldn't recommend it to anybody either. Okay, we need to talk about
it. We got to talk about what we read. Yeah, we're skipping search strategies. How did we find these? They're classics.
It was in the classics section.
Yeah. It said classics on it. It was in the classics section.
How many books did everybody read?
Just one.
One. Or, well, two-thirds of one.
I read one, and I read several adaptations, graphic novel adaptations, of several others. So I'll go first, then. I read The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson because it was my turn to read a Shirley Jackson book for the podcast. I believe she may be like the most read author on this podcast in terms of four specific genres.
Might be, yeah.
And this is the one that where in the introduction it said it's like falling out of people's memories or something like that, like about how it's no longer really considered. But at the same time, I'm like, well, but then they made the TV show, like the Netflix show a few years ago. And so suddenly it's like, you know, rebounded back into people's consciousness because they're like, oh, right, there's a book. Right. So like that affects whether things are classics as well. Like, is there an adaptation of it? I think. So it's a fairly slim book about a spooky house. And you know how I love spooky houses and how I hate being scared. So this book, I can really see why people like it so much. Also, skip the introduction if you read this thing. Holy shit. I skipped it because I knew. I'm like, this is the sort of book where the introduction is going to spoil everything.
Yeah. Everything. Yeah, definitely.
That's how you know it's a classic because the introduction assumes you already know the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. If there's a classic with the introduction, sometimes they are really great, like those introductions, but never read them before the book.
It's so annoying. I really dislike it. I've hated it since like I read a volume of The Sandman years ago that just spoiled half the plot points of the comic in the introduction. And I read the introduction first because like I didn't know any better.
It's at the front.
Yeah. It's like it's an afterword. Make them afterwards.
Yeah. Just put it at the end.
Anyway, what surprised me about The Haunting of Hill House was how the first several sections, chapters seem so modern for something from the 50s. And the way, like all you really had to do was add in like someone saying, oh, I don't get cell phone reception out here. And it could have been like set now is really kind of what I felt about it, which surprised me. But it's just like, there were two things about it. One was the main character's relationship with her family. Honestly, I was just like, oh, but like if it was her relationship with her job, it would be like so many people I know. And that is terrible.
Right.
It's like, oh, how do I get away from this terrible job? I can't escape this because I don't have any money and don't have any way to support myself and blah, blah, blah. And then also that she like co-owns a car with somebody and it's parked. So she has to take a taxi to get to the car. I'm like, oh, that's like now as well. People don't own cars anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's very Vancouver of me to say that.
Perhaps. I think a lot about that the scene where she's talking to her family about the car, and it's just Shirley Jackson's so good. It's just a conversation where the characters are like completely talking past each other, yep, and just like so clearly like exemplifies a dynamic, which is sort of hard to describe, but she doesn't sort of have to say directly like this relationship is fucked up in this way, but just like through dialogue, yeah, can create this sense of like, you know, this is how this character is feeling about this relationship, and this is all of the ways this other character does not get it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the middle section I felt was like a mixture of like 19th century Victorian ghost story and modern thing. And I'm like, God, that makes sense. It was written in the 50s, mm-hmm, which is between 19th century Victorian ghost story and modern things. The last part kind of lost me, although in part because I was ready for it to be scary and stuff, and I was reading it late at night. So I was alternating reading parts of it with reading superhero comics, to kind of like make it not have as much of an impact on me, which made it not have as much of an impact on me. So don't do that, I guess, is my advice.
But like, mission accomplished.
I guess, yeah.
I guess at least you know your way to do that when you need to.
But it made it probably a less enjoyable read. Like, I didn't really, I felt like I was like, oh wait, what? I don't get it. And it was just because I clearly was like, oh, but what's going on in Thunderbolts?
I think it also gets a little surreal and dreamlike at that point.
I also watched the first episode of the Netflix show. At double speed, so it was more like a comedy. And that it was like, when everything sped up, it's less scary.
Mm-hmm.
It was fine. It was an interesting adaptation because it was like none of the same characters or anything. It was just like, yeah, there's a spooky house. Now there are cell phones.
I guess I could do my nonfiction classic next. So I ended up reading In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
Ooh.
I have never read this before. It's always been, I've owned a copy for years and years, thinking I would read it, but I've never gotten around to reading it. So it is described as a like nonfiction novel or a true novel. So it's this interesting blend between like, it's sort of that interesting fictionalization of true things that's also really like based on the research and work done on that. It's also got like, this is one of those examples of a thing that I think is falls in that realm of a prime example of a certain genre, which is that true crime genre, that we come back to again as like again and again is like, you know, some sort of originating or important piece within that genre. But it also comes with a lot of mythologizing about the author themselves and their methodology and what the writing process meant in their life, and where this sat in our world at that time. So I feel like there's just a lot to unpack around the entire experience of reading this if you know some of that history, which is sort of an interesting experience. I also, by total random chance, so I haven't actually said, but In Cold Blood, of course, it's a true crime, obviously. It's about a murder that took place in 1959 where a family of four was killed. And it's also about, like, from the very beginning, you know basically who done it. And you're following them and the family through, and then the investigators and you know, people in the community through this process. And it's a lot of it is very much character driven. It's really about building characters. But it happens that simultaneously, just by chance, I had started listening to an audiobook version of All Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer by Michelle McNamara, which has a similar sort of interesting mythologizing around the author and the book and the writing process, because she actually died before the book was completed. And a lot of it is about the process of writing the book and about her process of researching this true crime, you know, this specific killer / serial rapist / ransacker, et cetera. And so it's frequently got sections in it where it is the editors popping in to say this was developed out of her notes, or like her notes suggest she had changed her mind on this after she wrote it, but we're going to presented as she wrote it, or this is based on like something that she had written up and posted on her blog or had published elsewhere. So it's piecing together her work out of all of her other works and her notes and what she had or hadn't got done in this manuscript. So comparing that, like doing this simultaneous with In Cold Blood, was just a really fascinating way to explore the genre of true crime literature. And what has changed or stayed the same, and what kind of influences came out of In Cold Blood, and just how we understand it culturally and its place in our lives. So anyways, I actually, it was an accident that I had this experience, but I kind of recommend having the experience this way because it's really very interesting.
That's really neat because I listened to In Cold Blood as an audiobook for one of our audiobook episodes. And it really blew me away because my only other experience with true crime at that point was like someone had donated a huge bag of really, I'm going to call them really trashy, like not as well written true crime. And so I was really impressed with the experience, although I haven't really gone back to true crime. I definitely have recommended it to other people.
Yeah, I can understand that for sure. I don't particularly, even though I'm finding both of the books, both of these, have found them both very interesting. I haven't finished either of them actually quite. I haven't quite got to the end of either. It doesn't help that I'm doing two at the same time and I keep going back and forth between them. But I don't think it's going to cause me to become deep into this genre. I'm just finding it a very interesting way to explore this genre and to understand it a little better. And it's a nice, like you say, that experience. A lot of what we have as experience with true crime is like I think back to my childhood and watching like Unsolved Mysteries, or like all of these A&E, whatever detective, like true detective shows and things. They're just like, they're not the things we think of as like good literature, well done in quality and type, but there's actually like, there is a lot out there that is better quality.
Yeah.
And done respectfully.
I think maybe a better word than trashy would be like sensationalistic and exploitative.
Yeah. Exploitative. Yeah, that's a big problem in that genre, and this is sort of an interesting way of exploring it, because that actually comes out explicitly. Like, it's a thing to understand about what's happening within Truman Capote's and some of the complexities of how that was written and why it was, you know, what happened around it. But it's also, like, something that's explicitly discussed a little bit in Michelle McNamara's work as well and what she was doing.
I don't think there's a graphic novel adaptation of In Cold Blood.
I don't know. I actually don't know about that.
Could be.
There's definitely several, like, both movies and documentaries, that which is another thing about, like, classics, is, like, there's, like, a tendency for adaptations. You can probably find a movie version.
Mm-hmm. I picked up my Penguin classic, Passing, by Nella Larsen, which is a...
Okay, Megan, I'm sorry. I was so excited for a moment there when you said, I picked up my penguin. I'm like, you have a penguin? Tell us more about your penguin.
Now I'm a little sad I don't have a penguin. He could live in the fridge.
It's probably for the best that you don't have one, to be honest. Like,
probably hard to take care of.
Yeah, like maybe you can get a plush one, I think. But
Plushy might be better.
You get a kitchen penguin.
Yes, a kitchen penguin. Very important.
Yes, get a kitchen penguin. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I don't know if they use litter boxes. So, you know, that would be a concern.
Yeah, the bird problem. So Passing was written originally in 1929. I read a 2018 reprint, which had an introduction and a further reading section by Emily Bernard and endnotes that were done by Thaddeus M. Davis in 1997, a prior edition. Nella Larsen is an acclaimed writer during the Harlem Renaissance period, which is early 20th century Black American creativity cultural scene in New York City. She only wrote two books, and this is the second of them. And it's about two women who had known each other as children. They'd lived in the same area of Chicago, and Then one of the women, her father died, and she ended up with some relatives and eventually just sort of fell off the map for Eileen, which is the second woman. And Eileen gets married, moves to New York, and is back in Chicago to visit her family, and ends up going to a hotel restaurant, and there's this woman staring at her, and it's freaking her out. And then realizes it's the grown-up version of the girl she grew up with. Carla, I think, is her name. Claire. And both of them are able to... They're black women, have black heritage and can pass for white, although... Eileen has chosen to marry a black man and have kids, where Claire is currently, like, lifetime passing for white. Her husband doesn't know. And so it ends up in a really charged, uncomfortable scene where three women, Claire, Eileen, and another woman who is able to pass for white, are having tea together at Claire's place when her husband walks in, and it is revealed he's very racist against black people. And so Claire manages to reinsert herself in Eileen's life, because I guess she misses the place where she grew up with and hadn't realized it as much, and causes Eileen lots of anguish, because the two women have sort of polar opposite views on life. Eileen is really clinging to an idea of safety and security in her life and can't always manage to control everything in it to obtain that, whereas Claire just wants what she wants and is aware that she doesn't have the kind of normal societal barriers that other people might have to prevent them from doing things to get what they want. It's a short novella of a book, about 110 pages, maybe. They've got some endnotes scattered throughout for some of the 1920s slang, if you miss any parts of it. And it's very impactful and very interesting. I always enjoyed it.
Can you tell us any cool slang?
let me flip. There was a good one for dancing. Tripped the light fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is dancing.
So I read at least the majority of, more than half of, I endeavored to read, the Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. I guess I will, we didn't do search strategy or that kind of thing, selections, but I really wanted this month to read Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, because in our Anthropology Month, I read a book that had some chapters of biography of Zora Neale Hurston. But my library only has like two copies of Their Eyes Were Watching God, and it was not available at... They don't have an ebook copy, and it was not available at my local bookstore at all. So, bummer on that front. I also started reading Frankenstein in ebook, and I think as far as reading classics, I did say a little earlier that I read a bunch in audiobook. I think if I read them in the future, print is the way I'm going to go, because it is so much easier to skim. Like, the edition of Frankenstein that I tried to read had four introductions.
Yowza.
And it is just so much easier in print to like skim those and see if they're worth reading than to like flip around and yeah, get to the actual content. So the Picture of Gorian Day. The Picture of Gorian Day. The Picture of Dorian Gray, the edition that I read, the Penguin Classics edition, the cloth bound, has a lot of endnotes giving both context about like references that Oscar Wilde makes, and also highlights areas where he changed the text between different versions that were published. which was super interesting, and I'm really glad that I read it in print so that I could easily flip back to that section and check it, and then go back to reading. And I used the little ribbon bookmark just to keep where I was in the appendix, then used a regular bookmark to keep where I was in the text. Double bookmarks. Advanced classics reading.
I love that. It's like, you know, the next level gamer techniques for reading a book. Mm-hmm, two bookmarks, yes, at the same time.
Pro strats, two bookmarks.
Skimming the introduction to speed running.
Yes, yes, definitely. If you don't know the plot of The Picture of Dorian Gray, I mean, he has a painting and it gets old and he stays young. I think that's the broad stroke. Plots.
RJ, I described my book as having a spooky house, and that was the only plot aspect I mentioned. So, like, you're doing great.
Thanks. I mean, I think it is sort of fascinating that, like, going in, I love Oscar Wilde. I've read The Importance of Being Earnest multiple times, and seen it on stage multiple times, and watched the not terribly great movie version of it, the one from the 90s, not the older one. So I really like Oscar Wilde, and have somewhere in my, like, parents' house in storage a big, huge, thick book of his collected works that...
Oh, I read all that, I think.
Yeah? but it was fascinating to me how much I didn't know about Picture of Dorian Gray. Like, we sort of know the broad strokes of the plot, where it's like, yeah, spooky house, or not spooky house, spooky painting.
Yeah, we all know this.
We all kind of went spooky. I don't know what Megan read yet, but we're 3 for 3 on kind of spooky, creepy reads.
Wait, Megan already said what she read.
Oh, I'm sorry. You read Passing. Right. She just talked about it. Not spooky. Well, 3 out of 4 spooky.
And Anna's was like, I don't know if spooky is the right word to describe it.
Creepy.
Yeah, unsettling.
Unsettling.
Spooky relationships.
Spooky relationships. I'm sorry. I was not fully engaged while you were talking, Megan. I'm very tired, and B, I was on my phone confirming that I had the dates right on the book list that I mentioned earlier, which I don't know. There's nothing from the 18th century. It's all, I think, like 1840s is the oldest thing on the book list, but oh well. Anyway, The Picture of Dorian Gray. I feel like I read quite a ways through it, and there are 3 main characters, at least up to the point that I am at. The titular Dorian Gray, and then his 2 friends, Basil the painter, who paints the portrait, and Lord Henry, who is a real Oscar Wilde type, is very witty and very, like, sort of, I want to say, like, I don't want to say, maybe amoral, not immoral necessarily, but just, like, cares more about, like, ideas and aesthetics and you know, experiences than right or wrong necessarily, which...
What did you say their name was, RJ?
Lord Henry?
Yeah. Do you think any lord is not amoral?
I mean, it's hard to say. Dorian Gray, through his friendship with Lord Henry, ends up developing these not great ideas about morality, and how he should conduct his life. And I'm sure someone somewhere has written an analysis of, like, Basil as a sort of angel on Dorian Gray's shoulder and Lord Henry as the devil on Dorian Gray's shoulder. Basil paints this beautiful, breathtaking portrait, but then feels unsettled by it. He says he put too much of himself into it and doesn't want anyone to see it, and gives it to Dorian Gray. Dorian Gray has it for all of, like, 3 days, and then does something very, very cruel and notices that the portrait has changed. I'm sort of at that place. I feel like there was so much novel that happened before it got to, like, the painting actually changing. And From what I understand, it deteriorates from there. But yeah, as I said, I'm a big Oscar Wilde fan, specifically of The Importance of Being Earnest. And it's so interesting to me to see sort of the same sort of elements of those characters, these like very sort of ridiculous rich people, being used here for horror instead of comedy. I feel like the first few chapters, I was like, la la la, this is a light read. This is fun. Oscar Wilde. Oh, people are saying witty things. And then there came a point where a character commits suicide. And I was like, oh, right. This is a horror novel. And the way that that sort of like, you know, fanciful, like, you know, witty aesthetes. What am I trying to say?
Sure.
The word for somebody who cares more about aesthetics than morals. That like, you know, slight whimsical remove that they have is that, you know, is played for laughs in some of his other works is horrifying to read when applied to like real human suffering. And yeah, I just think it is so fascinating, and I am planning to read the rest of it. And the endnotes have also been super interesting to see what things he changed. I also like didn't realize how homoerotic this whole novel is. Like, I mean, obviously, it is well known that Oscar Wilde was gay or bisexual, though didn't, you know, use that language for it, perhaps, and was persecuted for this. But like The Importance of Being Earnest does not have the same sort of gay subtext as this, like, very clearly does, and even more clearly when you read the endnotes and see like the kinds of things that his publisher asked him to cut out, where like Basil is confessing to Dorian why he doesn't want anyone to look at the painting, and says, you know, like, I worship you with in the original version, it's like, I worship you with like more romance than any man should have for a friend. And yeah, I think like even without that more explicit reference, it is still super clear to me, like as a queer reader, that this is a queer text. And I feel like so frequently we get the broad strokes of like spooky painting, and I wish I had heard more about like, you know, it, as a classic, as like queer horror. I forgot to mention that there's a bunch of picture of Dorian Gray that's super anti-Semitic, which I did want to mention. And I think, yeah, I probably a disclaimer that we can put on most of the classics we mentioned. Is that
you
might run into some content that has not aged well.
Yep.
I think that's all I have to say about Dorian Gray. Ooh, I do like this. I did skip the introduction, and in the introduction to this one, there's a note at the top that says, new readers are advised that this introduction makes the detail of the plot explicit.
A plus, good job.
Good job, introduction writer.
Yay! Gosh.
So I read four adaptations of various classics as well this month.
Mm-hmm.
And three of them are from the manga classics line, and who are a company that pay me to promote their comics to library and educator folks, which mostly just involves posting about it on social media in Facebook groups and stuff like that. But I also read them this month. And so the three of that one, those ones I read were the adaptations of The Scarlet Letter, The Count of Monte Cristo, and Pride and Prejudice, which I think most people would agree are all classics of one form or another. And these are also ones where some of them are classics. They're adaptations of the Shakespeare plays, use every line of dialogue from the plays. And so they're really just illustrated scripts in that way. But these ones are adaptations that, like, you know, aspects of the stories are cut out and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Reading these three, I realized I didn't even know what went on in them. I had like, it's like, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, The Scarlet Letter, that book about a woman who has a letter on her. I don't know what it's about, especially that one, because it's like, seems very much more American to me than some of the others. But like The Count of Monte Cristo, I don't think I had any idea what that book was about at all. Like, it's about like revenge and stuff. It was a cool story. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I would never have read the original, in part because like the way they're written doesn't appeal to me very much. Like, the old classics, like, the stories can be really good, but the writing style is so different from something that's modern, I feel. And then the third one, the Pride and Prejudice, it's another of these things. It's just like, yeah, sure, like, I theoretically know the story of Pride and Prejudice, but I couldn't have told you anything about it. Funnier than I expected.
Yeah, it's very funny.
But I think that if I read it in prose, I wouldn't have found it funny. Because I wouldn't have understood what was a joke or not. Whereas when it was drawn and the character was acting really ridiculously, I'm like, oh, this is a joke.
I was in a playwriting class in university, and we read The Importance of Being Earnest. And like the day that, you know, we were assigned to have it finished and discuss it, I was very excited because I had already seen it and read it before and loved it. And I'd say most of the class did not realize it was a comedy.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So it is just really interesting to read these and think about like the context we don't have for them. And the other thing that I really appreciated from them is like all the characters, they're not modern retellings, you know, all the characters are in period clothing. The Count of Monte Cristo, and there's a little bit at the end about how they did the adaptation, and the writer is like, oh, I went to like the prison that the prison in The Count of Monte Cristo was based on. So we redid the art so that the prison cell was more accurate.
Wow.
Which is like the attention to detail that's done in some of these things, which is pretty cool. But yeah, when you're reading, it's something that I think about a lot when you're reading books set in the past that were not books, but books that were written in the past. It's like they don't necessarily explain what people are wearing because it's just what everybody was wearing. Whereas in the comic version, I'm like, I can understand what they're wearing better because it's a picture. And the other one I read was an adaptation of I Am a Cat, which is on the book list you put together, RJ, which is an early 20th century Japanese novel that's a classic. And it's a comedy. And I did not understand the humor because I did not have the context for what it was about. Like, I could understand, like, I'm like, oh, I bet this is funny if I understood the context, that sort of thing. And that's, I think, one of the problems with the classics as well is like, especially for older stuff, it's like the context of these is so much of the impact they can have on us. It's like, I think it's one of the challenges people have when they're reading stuff like Shakespeare and things. They're like, why is this funny? Why is this important? Why am I studying this?
Yeah.
When you're like, I can't even understand what's going on and I don't have any context surrounding it. And it can make, you know, it creates this barrier between people successfully understanding it and appreciating it and just from like a first read, I guess. Does that make sense? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, I enjoyed them, you know? Like I thought I haven't read the originals of any of them, so I can't say how good an adaptation it is, but they seem, everyone else has said that they're really good adaptations. I think they were entertaining. Check them out if you don't think you're going to read all of Pride and Prejudice, but you want to know the story. This is a way for you to do it, I think.
When we went to ALA in 2015, Matthew, you gave me a manga that was like an adaptation of Emma. Was that the same?
Yeah, that's probably almost certainly from this line.
Yeah, I remember reading it and enjoying it and then being like, oh, now I understand the movie Clue.
Yes.
Or Clueless.
Yeah.
Yes.
Clueless.
Not Clue.
Clue is not Clue. Yes.
It's like, wait, that's not quite right.
Clue is a very abstract adaptation of Emma.
I talked to somebody a while ago who said that they had a student who was doing, who wrote an essay that was a comparison of Clueless, the manga classics adaptation, and the original text. And looking at it through these three different ways, which I'm like, that's really cool. That's awesome to see that, like, that much, like, being able to compare it in those ways is really interesting.
Yeah, I feel like some people might look down on like consuming classics through adaptations, but then once you do that, you have so much more context for understanding the original.
Yeah.
Like if you do something like that where you're like reading both, and then it's a doorway into like reading something that might have been inaccessible otherwise.
And I do think that I would love to see more plays adapted into comics because I think that it is like a play script is not how you're supposed to experience a play.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think they're a really good way to read plays and understand what's going on and see what's happening.
Yeah, I think that there is sort of a relationship there too between getting the different types of adaptations to these classics and like my experience of like wanting to be able to talk about them with others. Yes. It's all just versions of how to unpack what's happening and understand it better and get more out of it.
It is the thing. It's like if you're teaching this sort of stuff, it's like, do you want people to know the story and plot and characters, or do you want people to know about the language that's being used? Because those are two different things. I'll also say when doing this, I saw there was another adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo, like another manga one.
Mm-hmm.
Huge boobs on the women in that one. And I'm just like, whoa, like that's what I noticed from the cover. I'm like, I'm sure some people picked this up and did not get the sort of comic they expected. So that's not published by the Manga Classics line.
I was going to mention that The Count of Monte Cristo is also on the list of books, classics by authors of color, because I never realized that Alexandre Dumas was multiracial.
Yep.
Are we at appeal factors?
I believe we are.
I think to sort of segue from what you were talking about context, Matthew, I feel like one of the values of reading classics to me is always having or getting from reading classics more context about both like other literary works from that period, about that period of time in history, and about like, you know, modern literature and literature, big picture, the all of it. I don't know that I have a good, well, I guess like reading Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre, which I read two of the ones I read in audiobook many years ago. I feel like there are so many references to them in other works that I have been able to like appreciate more from having read them. Or just like not necessarily direct references, but just like the way things are structured or like, yeah, less direct references, but just obvious influences that I'm able to appreciate more deeply. I feel like I wish I had read Frankenstein so I could talk about the book, but when I think about like classics and what I get from them, I often think about watching Frankenstein the film, and both having this experience of seeing like the shot with the storm and the castle and being like, oh, that's an archetype now.
Yeah.
And that was the first time, just like having this experience of watching it and being like, oh, this is the first time people saw shit like this. And watching and reading classic films and classic literature and trying to put myself in the mindset of somebody for whom this is not a classic and not, you know, has like thousands of imitators and reference points, but this is new and fresh and thinking about how it might hit from that perspective.
Yeah.
In Frankenstein also, there is like one scene that I feel like never saw talked about. Again, there's like that broad strokes versus like details.
Is there a cowboy in that one too?
There's not a cowboy in that one. But yeah, it is that kind of thing where it's like everyone knows the broad strokes of these stories, but there's all of these like super interesting details that we don't necessarily get from just knowing those broad strokes. And I feel like I talked a little bit about that in Dorian Gray, but in Frankenstein, there is a scene where like the little girl who drowned her father is like carrying her through the streets with this just like blank look on his face, and it's like completely silent except for like his stomping footsteps. And for me, it is like, you know, was not too scary for me because it was not like a jump scare or anything, but was like one of the scariest things I've seen in a movie. And it is not a scene that I have seen like discussed broadly, but I'm so glad that I watched the original Frankenstein to like absorb something besides all of our huge mass of broad cultural references to it.
It is definitely funny to me when occasionally I will read or experience some form of quote unquote classic media, and then suddenly understand a Simpsons joke from the 1990s.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, that was a reference to this thing. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
I think the only other appeal I might mention is that classics is kind of like a curated list of material. If you don't want, like, don't want to take a chance on something that might not be as good, you could go towards the classics to, for a certain expectation of writing style and level of skill, probably.
Yeah. I mean, I guess related to that, if we're being very blunt about it, there is a reader for whom reading the classics is a way of adding to their social credit.
Mm.
So there is something there as well of, like, for some readers, that is a particular part of the appeal. And so there is a value in reading a certain set of items that are understood to be the classics.
I just thought you put that on your bookshelf behind your Zoom call.
Yeah.
Thing. You don't have to actually read them.
My background in the Zoom call is Lego sets and comic books, Megan.
Sure. Yeah, I know. Right.
Listen, for a certain type of reader, maybe you are flaunting your reading acumen.
Definitely flaunting the Lego sets. Yes, you're right.
Yes.
Yes.
I have a friend who, during the pandemic, started a reading project where he is reading all of the, I think it's the Penguin ones, the cloth-bound classics. He's on Instagram at cloth-bound connoisseur, if you want to see his progress. But I feel like, as you were saying, like a curated list, like this sort of pre-made list, not just because you want to, like, guarantee that it'll be a certain level of quality or because it comes with a certain status, but just because there's too many books to read. There's too many choices.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, yeah, classics sort of provide this handy list of, like, if you want a taste of this time period, read this thing, and here's a bunch.
Yeah. You don't have to make choices or decisions. It's just, they've already done that for you. And it's very easy to find lots of background and further information on all of these books and unpack a lot of things with a quick little search around the internet.
So, maybe as an ending note, we could each recommend a classic that we did not talk about in this episode that people could read.
Oh, well, you didn't give me warning for that.
You're getting warning now. I will go first so that I can give you all 30 seconds to think of something. My classic that I would recommend is The Nose by Nikolai Gogol, who was a Ukrainian-Russian writer in the 19th century. The Nose is a short story. You can find translations of it for free on the internet. It's about a guy who wakes up one day and his nose has disappeared. And then it turns out his nose has been walking around town pretending to be like a nobleman. By having a hat pulled down really far and a collar on his shirt, like on his jacket up, so that people can't tell that it's just a nose. It's pretty ridiculous. And I don't know, I enjoyed it a lot. And also, how often do I get to talk about things I read for my, like, my Russian literature degree, my Russian studies degree?
Frantically checking my Goodreads.
It's fine.
I know.
It's, yeah. It's, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, you can take 5 minutes. I can edit this out.
It's true.
That's what editing, we're not live.
You did this and you have to edit it, so.
Hey, 5 minutes of silence is very easy to edit out.
That's true.
No, it's just going to be a lot of typing. What are you talking about?
I mean, I would recommend another Shirley Jackson book, but.
That one?
Yeah, the one that I own. Yeah, we have always lived in the castle, but it is one that I know we've talked about on the show before.
Yep, it is good.
I believe it's a bingo square at this point.
Yeah.
I think Shirley, I didn't actually update it, but Shirley Jackson was in the, like, to be added to bingo squares.
For sure. Ugh, I mean, the first answer that I thought of, I feel like is super boring because this is one that many people have read, but that's classics. Like,
yes.
I kind of can't name something that not a lot of people have read. I mean, maybe Stone Butch Blues, but I've already mentioned it. That is a good one to read. I'll recommend, if you haven't read it, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. It is a classic for a reason. And I think I experienced with it, and a lot of people that I know who have read it sort of experienced, like, really being surprised by it. I think in a similar way to, like, what you were talking about, Matthew, reading The Haunting of Hill House, where it feels very modern.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it could have been written today, and it is part of that, I think, is the sort of weirdness and the sort of tone that doesn't feel like how we expect a classic book to feel, right, necessarily. Yeah. It feels much more accessible, I guess, and still, you know, very like smart and engaging and thoughtful, but in a way that also reads as like clever and inviting and not necessarily as inaccessible as you imagine a classic to be.
I think it's easy for us to forget that people in the past were just as intelligent and weird as we are now.
Yeah.
They just didn't have cell phones.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, can you imagine like Oscar Wilde on Twitter?
Yeah, he'd be very popular. And also, I think,
or very unpopular.
And I was like, yeah, like, I was going to say, and but, also would get super canceled.
But he'd be perfectly happy with that.
Yeah.
Because as long as his account isn't blocked. Because what is it? The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, that's Twitter. Anna and Megan, any ideas, or are you both unable to think of something?
No, this is nonsense.
I mean, there are so many different things that I could mention, so it's hard to like figure out. And I didn't pre-think ahead of these, but I guess like if I think about the ones that I was particularly surprised by reading, that the experience was different than I would thought it would be. The two that kind of more immediately come to mind are actually reading Peter Pan, like actually reading it, not just like all the versions we had, because I don't think very many people actually read Peter Pan. I think we tend to experience it as the Disney kind of version or the like the various movies that have come out. And so I think that it was way more interesting to read it and be like, oh, there's some stuff going on in here. Oh, there's some stuff. So I think Peter Pan would be one. And the other one that comes to mind is Moll Flanders, which is definitely one of those experiences of like, wow, this is just a rip-roaring story that like just is not told in the type of language, like in the, you know, manner or whatever that we would use now. But oh my gosh, even around that, I can tell this is just a rip-roaring story of just like a wild, chaotic, amazing, crazy life that has just been turned into a very adventuresome book. I think we overwhelmed Megan.
I don't know. Read what you want. I don't care.
Yeah. Like, we were doing a finishing note, but one of the things I didn't get to say that I kind of wanted to say from the appeal factor section is actually the process of how the canon changes and the classics change over time. They are flexible and we can shift that to some degree. But some of that is like these things that come from niche communities or from marginalized communities or from niche genres and pulling them forward and exploring why are these so important? They actually are a big part of our conversations and they end up in our lexicon a lot. And we don't know that that's where this stuff came from because we haven't put them into our classics and we haven't put them into our canon. But they do actually feed into our culture a lot. And so I think it's important that we find some of those, especially speaking to those of us here who are librarians, who have the capacity to do this, if you do, to find some of these and put them forward. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, subscribe so you never miss an episode and consider giving us a positive rating and or review. That's very helpful. And if you've already done that, thank you very much. We appreciate you.
I forgot the other announcement, RJ. We streamed our Pokemon ranking. It's on our YouTube channel.
Okay, you want to say that now?
No, it's fine. I just did.
You just did.
For all our URLs and social media accounts, the four in our name is a numeral. You can go to our website at bookclubform.com, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/bookclubform, and find us on Twitter and on Instagram at bookclubform. Our email address is bookclubform@gmail.com.
On our website, you can find show notes that will provide links to things we mentioned in this episode, social media info for everyone who appeared on this episode, and our genre-based book lists of titles by authors of color.
We have a form you can fill out if you'd like to give us a book recommendation or request a recommendation. We can't promise we'll read any books that you suggest, but we will absolutely provide a recommendation if you ask for one.
All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment if they exist.
Our theme music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun from the Free Music Archive.
New episodes are the first and third Tuesday of every month.
Join us again on Tuesday, June 21st. We'll be talking about beach reads.
Then on Tuesday, July 7th, we will be discussing the genre of humor, not fiction.
Great. Thank you, everybody. Sorry for asking annoying questions. As though, I guess you should be yes to that by this point.
I feel like there are so many, like...
cats?
So many cats. Ernie has a lot of opinions about classics.
Your cats.
Oh, I know. The cats are making 500% more noise than normal.
Sorry, they're really excited to have Matthew there, that's all. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. I'm wondering like what celebrity cats from the past would exist on like social media.
Nikola Tesla never married, but he admitted to falling in love with a very special white pigeon. It was a pigeon.
What? I clearly have not been paying attention. What the heck is happening right now?
Hey, cat!
Hey.
No, no eat wire.
No eat wires. Wires aren't food or toy.